3.5 million people live in that land. The greatest military force in the history of the world is headquartered there in the Pentagon. It's a pretty important hunk of land of 500,000 acres. That was Washington's homeland, the northern edge of Virginia.
Welcome back to the Kevin Roberts Show. I have an exciting episode. Well, it's at least exciting for me, and I think, therefore, it's going to be exciting for you. Those of you who are real aficionados of politics, which I would presume would be all of you, will know this guest I'm about to introduce. Maybe if you're on the younger side of the spectrum, maybe you know him less well, but I think a lot of you will be excited to know that a gentleman that I've just met, someone I'm going to consider a friend now, someone I've respected for a long time because of his intellectual acumen, Michael Barone. Thanks for being here.
Well, thank you, sir.
And for those people who've tuned in via video rather than just audio, they can see that you're dressed in a very dapper way with burnt orange, which tells me you got the memo about the University of Texas.
Well, it's fall colors as far as I'm concerned. I grew up in Michigan, north of Canada, Detroit, Michigan. We were not reconciled to the annexation of Texas, and so the coloring thing is coincidental to Texas.
I take back everything nice I just said about you.
Okay.
Just kidding. Thanks for being here. You have a distinguished career. You're senior political analyst at the Washington Examiner. You are a senior fellow emeritus at American Enterprise Institute. And for a lot of us, we know that you were one of the founders of the Almanac of American Politics. And I will tell you a story that you've not yet heard from me. Do you remember the now defunct bookstore chain, Walden Books?
Absolutely.
So that was my first job. And first job, you know, outside of helping people, you know, farms or whatever. So I'm 15 or 16 in high school and always had the closing night shift because I was at school during the day. And my job, while the manager was counting the money, because just being a 16-year-old kid, I couldn't be entrusted with the money, right, was to reshelve all of the books. And it was supposed to take you 30 minutes to do this, but I got it down to a science of doing it in 12 or 15 minutes so that I could preserve the remaining 15 minutes being a political junkie to read the Institute of American Politics. But there's a postscript to this story, Michael Barone. And it is, I did this for months. And finally, my manager, a very sweet lady, walked by one night and she said, I think you ought to buy it because you kind of wore it out.
Oh, dear.
So I felt like I've known you for a long time. Well, and thank you for your, not just your intellectual rigor, your love for history. We're going to talk about your most recent book here in a little bit, but also the gentlemanly manner in which you have gone through commentary about some difficult things. I know I can speak for a lot of people in the audience that we're grateful for that.
Well, I've been writing and doing about politics and about how other people feel about things. You know, we have a lot of people today that say if you're not the same color as somebody else, you can't possibly understand what they feel. Well, for about 60 years, I've been writing for publication and for profit, and I hope you did finally buy the book.
I did. Yeah. I've bought it at least a few times. That Almanac of American Politics is really
But I've been writing that, and part of that in a country like ours is inevitably trying to understand people who are operating from different perspectives, have different beliefs, may have quite different points of view or similar on some issues, and to try and understand what makes them tick, what goes on, how this small D Democratic, small R Republican process works. And you got to understand people who are different from you. Not just assert your own identity. So I've tried to do that. I try to be polite. I've tried to, in my Almanac American Politics, I'd write write-ups of each state and put in some of the history there. And the point of view that I came to was that each time I did this, and I was writing these over a period of 40 years, I operated from a point of view of how would I feel if I lived in this state and liked living in this state and so forth. I liked living in the flyover state. So I think that that was worth doing because, you know, there are people in North Dakota who really like being in North Dakota and do good things in North Dakota.
And we want people in each state to have pride in their state. That is to say, that's helpful for them socially, culturally, as they build institutions. But it's also this one aspect of the system on which our country is based, federalism. How grave a problem is it that too many Americans have forgotten that reality, the importance of federalism?
Well, it's a problem that we have a heritage in this country that's a very interesting one. It's also a heritage that goes back rather a while. And it's hard, I'm now of an age where I can remember. I was born during World War II. I did not do any commentary on Fox News on election night 1944, but that Fox News didn't exist then. And I'm not sure I was capable of the commentary, but I was alive then. And, we were 70-some years, 80 years closer to the founding then than we were now. So there were people alive when I was born who were alive during the Civil War. There were people who, we still have some connections. President John Tyler was born in 1790. One of President John Tyler's grandsons owns his house in Virginia. He's an elderly man now. So there's a connection that goes back. But when I tell people that, they're astonished. How can this possibly be? Well, Tyler had two marriages. This was a younger son of a later marriage and so forth and so on. But
to be clear, this is a grandson, not a great-grandson.
A grandson of a man born in 1790. But 1790 is a long time ago. And I think one of the other things that's hard to imagine is the Revolutionary period, the early Republic, is a little harder for us to get our imaginations into than the Civil War period. In the Civil War period, you have people, you have trains, and they're important in the Civil War, as a matter of fact. You have the telegraph instantaneously transmitting information in a way that we can relate to. You had steel plants producing steel that produced locomotives and things like that. They were wearing clothes that we could imagine putting on and buttoning up and figuring out how to handle. When you go back to the Revolution, when you go back to the colonial period and the period of the early Republic, you don't have any of that. There are no trains. They're trudging over the mountains. They're on horseback. You don't have the telegraph, instantaneous communication. On the contrary, you have huge amounts of uncertainty that goes on in a wartime period or in peacetime problems. We ended the War of 1812 by signing the Treaty of Ghent, but that was 15, 18 days before the Battle of New Orleans because they didn't hear about it. News didn't get to them. We have very great difficulty imagining how we would wear those clothes and how we would have powder our wigs and things like that. It's just a period that's more difficult for us all to put into our minds. And so I think that that's one of the reasons. And I think the other thing is that this story has a lot of heroic figures. It has a lot of people who the Revolutionary period, the making of the Constitution, really extraordinary figures. It's hard to appreciate how important they were. Some of us ask the question, how did a new republic with 3 million some people come up with leaders like Washington, Jefferson, Hamilton, Franklin, Madison, et cetera, and the country of 333 million today comes up in the minds of some people with figures that are inferior to them. It's a little hard to stretch your mind around. So we have to exercise our imagination if we want to get around it. When we do so, I think one of the conclusions we come to, at least I come to, is how lucky we are. We are proud of our heritage, not necessarily because we as individuals are just super and wonderful and have done everything great, but we're the lucky beneficiaries, the lucky heirs of some really extraordinary people and of some events that happened as a result of contingencies that were very unlikely in some circumstances.
Which offer a parallel to this age, we might argue any age, right? But it seems as if in elementary school classrooms, college classrooms, perhaps because of the conceit of the bias of some of the instruction, that we're no longer drawing those parallels in a way that allows students to appreciate that. And I think that leads in turn to a lack of appreciation for the founding era generally.
Well, it's hard for people to imagine it. And for those for products of the academy and otherwise that want to divide the world into oppressed and oppressors, the United States, which by so many measures is the most successful entity of the world, we are 5% of the population, 25% of the world's economy, over half of the world's military capacity, and so forth. It's so big, so powerful, so successful, it's got to be an oppressor. And they're looking for oppressors all around. I think that's the wrong way to look. That's a wrong way to look at history, a wrong way to look at what's going on and what has happened in the past.
So let me ask you a political question, and then we'll get into the book specifically. Do you think that it is helpful for conservative elected officials or would-be elected officials to reference the American founding as often as they do, reference the Constitution as often as they do? I happen to think this is a good idea, but you can account for my bias, right? The reason I ask that question, Michael, is sometimes I hear, particularly from younger people, even younger people on the political right, that while they appreciate the Constitution, of course, they appreciate the American founding, that those references are now lost. That's the word they use, lost on the American populace writ large.
Well, if they're lost, maybe we should try and find them.
I'm with you.
Yeah. I think bringing some history into it is important. And some of our great leaders specialized many ways of bringing in history. When you think of Lincoln, he says, all homage to Jefferson. He was actually a member of a political party that had seemingly been in opposition to Jefferson's party and so forth. But he Franklin Roosevelt, not a favorite necessarily at the Heritage Foundation.
Not usually.
But he also is trying to identify his Democratic administration with the Republican administration of Abraham Lincoln and with the Democratic administration of Thomas Jefferson. He builds the Jefferson Memorial in the Tidal Basin of Washington. It's dedicated in 1943. It's the thing you can see if you look out from the windows of the White House. Roosevelt in his wheelchair could go and see the Jefferson Memorial and know that the statue of Jefferson was there. Those were appeals to history that were pretty powerful. And I think that great statesmen, effective statesmen, effective politicians can profit by helping to teach the public about things that their schools may or may not have taught them much about.
I said one political question, but there's going to be a second one before we get into the book. I promise we're going to get into the book. Does this era, maybe just say decade, we'll confine ourselves to the decade, even though we're not quite halfway through the decade. Does this decade in the United States politically remind you of a particular decade?
Does it remind me of a particular decade in American history? I'm tempted to say one of the decades in the post-Civil War period where we have the idea that there are, history has generally taught us that there are no heroes. The history of this period was written by the progressives and the robber barons. This was a book by the Marxist Matthew Josephson, very magazine writer. He was a vivid writer. I read that book when I was in college. at Harvard. You know, they taught that one. Well, robber barons, these people created industries that simply would not have been created if they hadn't been so clever. I mean, you know, John D. Rockefeller, among other things that John D. Rockefeller did by establishing the oil business, he saved the whales. Because whale oil had been used for interior lighting, and the major product of the oil business in the 19th century wasn't gasoline. We didn't have motor cars. It was kerosene that people used for kerosene lamps in the house. So you had great fortunes created out of whaling, as Moby Dick reminds us, in the years before the Civil War, and the mansions you can see today in Nantucket, although almost none of us can afford to buy one of them. But after the Civil War, they're doing that. And John D. Rockefeller also created, really, the whole field of advanced medicine and medical research and university hospitals and so forth. Medical research was created out of his fortune deliberately by him. And, oh, yeah, he created the University of Chicago and
that too.
A bunch of other things, Colonial Williamsburg. He wasn't robbing anybody. He was creating something, and then both in his business and in philanthropy, that contributed to human flourishing.
Thank you for that. Now we will get into the book, I promise, entitled Mental Maps of the Founders, How Geographic Imagination Guided America's Revolutionary Leaders. People who are tuning in via video can see the book there. And I just finished this today, as I mentioned to you as you arrived.
Wow.
It's really good.
Oh, well, thank you.
And I'm not merely being courteous and polite by saying that. It's really good.
Well, thank you. Well, it was a fun project for me. And
I could tell you had fun with it.
Yeah, during the, getting into the COVID period, one of the things I've done over the last 25 years, like many Americans, is to read all the great books about the founders. We had a whole series of academic historians, the colonial and revolutionary and early republic years, really a whole cadre of really terrific people, and non-academic historians have done terrific books, the Ron Chernow and others, first-class works, and that have become public successes. I mean, Chernow's gotten rich off this. Well, I'm delighted to see that. He deserves it. And I had read some of these, and I thought, well, I'd like to learn more about this. And my old friend Luke Cannon, the great reporter and Reagan biographer, Luke Cannon once said to me, if you want to really learn a lot about a subject, write a book about it. So I thought, well, what can I contribute? I'm a journalist. I've got a law degree way back in my jagged past. I've read something about these. What unique contribution could I make? And I thought, maps. I've always been a map buff. I grew up in Northwest Detroit, where we had square miles. I grew up just south of 8 Mile, which is now famous, and 7.5 Mile. And these square grids, the square mile grids that Thomas Jefferson actually proposed as a member of the Confederation Congress in the 1780s. And you can see them if you fly across the country. You can see them from parts of Pennsylvania, New Jersey, and so forth, west all the way to Orange County, California, if you've got a clear day on your flight. And a window seat. The maps and so forth. And I thought, well, let's look at these people, how they saw the maps. Because the 18th century, of course, they didn't have accurate maps of all of North America. They didn't know where things were. They also didn't have a concept of what it was a new nation. I mean, the revolutionary leaders did not sit down and say, well, the United States is going to go here, and New Jersey will be separated from Pennsylvania. They did not have all this set out. They did not know what the limits of the new nation would be and what would be in it and what wouldn't. If you remember, in 1775, one of the first things they do, they send expeditions to Montreal and Quebec because they think that the French-speaking Catholics in Montreal and Quebec are going to want to join them. Uh-uh. Unsuccessful. Their general Montgomery
Wolfing
dies.
So, yeah.
Tragically and so forth. So They didn't know what was going on. So the geography, I thought, would be interesting. So I did more reading and research, and with a view to try and draw up their mental maps. And the result is this book, which consists basically of six essays on six founders about their mental maps and about the consequences this had for their leadership and the implications for what kind of a nation we became and what kind of a nation we hope we can make ourselves be.
It's, you know, when I saw the title of the book, and I try to read a book before I read any reviews, the reviews have been very good, fittingly, I said, I think I know what he's getting at. And it was what you just described. But then when I started reading the book over the weekend, a few days ago, I thought, wow, he's really starting with geography. And what clicked for me mentally was your story in the introduction about growing up in Northwest Detroit. And you said, you know, almost verbatim, it was living that out there, the square mile with roads that ran perfectly north, south, and east, west, you could learn the cardinal directions better than you could know left from right.
Well,
and if you start with that concept and you, the way I will describe it, obviously I'll ask you to describe this in your own words, and you put Benjamin Franklin in a particular spot and what he was seeing, for someone who's intrigued by this, what's novel about this, a real contribution to history, to our own understanding of our country as Americans, is that we really, through this book, get to see important events through the eyes of these founders using this concept of their mental maps.
Well, thank you.
It really is innovative.
Well, it was one way to do it. I mean, Gordon Wood, whom I had met a number of times, was one of the really last members of that generation. I think Gordon Wood is in his 90s now. Yeah. He's still active, still alert. And I asked him and gave me a blurb on this, and he said, nobody else has actually looked at the founders in this particular way. So I guess I was able to make something of a unique contribution to a subject which can bear all sorts of study and reflection.
Not bad for an attorney, political scientist, journalist.
Well, just another guy on the street.
Yes, Michael Barone, you're just another guy on the street. You mind if I read a few sentences of your words?
Oh, sure.
This is terrific prose, by the way. You don't need to hear this from me,
but
in an era when we don't see terrific prose, this is for people in the audience who play with writing, just listen to this. George Washington was not always the tight-lipped icon of the Gilbert Stuart portraits or the dazzlingly uniformed general mounted on a white steed. He was once a young man with red-brown hair from an outer corner of Virginia with limited prospects, a fine horseman with a knack for meticulous diary entries and precise calculations, the younger son of the second marriage of a Virginia planter whose death when he was 11 deprived him of the English education received by his older brothers. There was no indication that his early military exploits would bring him to the attention of one British king or that his leadership of a rebellion against his successor and his subsequent renunciation of power would lead that monarch to hail him as, quote, the greatest man in the world. Here's the punchline. This is the point about the mental maps. You continue. His accomplishments and his rise to fame owe much to the territory on the map which he always considered his home. From his birth in the narrow northern neck between northern Virginia's two great rivers to his boyhood home overlooking the Rappahannock and his mansion, Mount Vernon, overlooking the Potomac. This explains the book. It's also just a beautiful paragraph.
Oh, gosh. Thank you very much. I wanted to suggest a way of looking at George Washington. We always worry about his teeth and the Gilbert Stuart portraits and so forth. And to suggest that he didn't start off as the first man in the country, as first in war, first in peace, first in the hearts of his countrymen. He started off, a privileged class, landowners and so forth, but not from a fairly propitious thing. I mean, Thomas Jefferson actually started off with a much better prospects as an eldest son who inherited a whole lot of money early on and enough money to live comfortably for the rest of his life, basically, and so forth. So I wanted to get us in the minds of Washington. And I also suggest, as I get on in that chapter of George Washington, some of the contingencies that are involved there, some of the facts that almost accidents of history that make him come forward. And the one of them is that, I mentioned the Rappahannock and the Potomac in that passage. Well, in fact, that land, as I explain on there, is part of the Fairfax Grant. Lord Fairfax, the only British member of the House of Lords who lived in North America, had owned this grant, which was initiated by King Charles II in 1649 when he was in exile during the English Revolution and didn't really have any power over it at all. He sold it to try and collect a little rent money, I think. Everything between the Rappahannock River and the Potomac River west from the Chesapeake to the source of the rivers in the mountains, a huge expanse of land. The 3.5 million people live in that land. The greatest military force in the history of the world is headquartered there in the Pentagon. It's a pretty important hunk of land of 500,000 acres. That was Washington's homeland, the northern edge of Virginia. Lord Fairfax, and Washington's half-brother, Lawrence, marries into the Fairfax family, Lord Fairfax's grandniece, I believe. And the 17-year-old Washington comes, Lord Fairfax, having spent 11 years in the courts in London perfecting his grant against the locals in Virginia that wanted to challenge it, hires George Washington to be a surveyor on his land. He's 17 years old. He's a good horseman. He's a meticulous guy. He's learning. He has a big temper, but he's learning to control it. And he's willing to go out in the wilderness and to survey things and to use all these cumbersome tools that they use for surveying. And you go out when it gets cold. You don't want to survey when the tree leaves are all out in the summer. You don't go out till October, November, and so forth. And he gets that frontier experience, which then commends itself to the House of Burgesses when they're looking for somebody to go warn the French not to advance into the forks of the Ohio, where the Allegheny and Monongahela rivers come together to form the Ohio River, site of Pittsburgh today. They send the 21-year-old George Washington up there. And of course, in the Second Continental Congress, in 1775, is looking for a military commander. There is a member of the House of Burgesses of Virginia in his uniform with the Fairfax County Militia, buff and blue, is George Washington, almost one of the very few colonials who had significant military experience. And he's appointed commander-in-chief. We get a Cincinnatus as our leader there, a man who will relinquish power, who will resign a commission in the military and go back to being a private citizen, who will be elected president unanimously and will voluntarily retire and return to his farm, and who at the last year of his life will scratch out on a piece of paper on his own, in his own quill pen, words which will free his slaves. And we get that kind of a man as a leader. That's a whole series of coincidences, and it makes me think Washington, in his farewell address in Annapolis when he's resigning his military commission, refers to, have we seen the interposition of providence here? Well, if you're a religious believer, you may believe, as many Americans believed over the years, that somebody up there was looking out for us when we found this kind of a leader in this kind of unlikely setting. And it was the maps that did it, sending him out into the out beyond the Blue Ridge. He buys his first land in the Shenandoah Valley at age 18, sending him out to the forks of the Ohio within 15 miles of Lake Erie.
Without the maps, without the need to improve the maps, we don't get George Washington as we know him.
Well, we don't. And he had one of the maps that he took with him on one of these journeys. It wasn't very good beyond the first Appalachian chain. Was drawn by two plantation owners who went out in the West themselves, named Joshua Fry and Peter Jefferson, the father of Thomas Jefferson.
Speaking of Peter Jefferson, Thomas Jefferson is one of the other chapters or focuses of the book, Benjamin Franklin. Any story from the three that we've mentioned, Washington, Jefferson, Franklin, or the other three in the book that really surprised you, that's really stuck with you after finishing the book and publishing it?
Well, one of the stories that surprises me about Jefferson is that he wasn't much of a traveler. He loved maps. He didn't like traveling, and one thought I had was, well, actually, traveling was pretty darn inconvenient in the 17th century. If you had a nice house, you would do it. You might want to stay home. Jefferson's father, Peter Jefferson, went out to establish what's called the Fairfax Stone. I drove out to it. It's where the western tip of Maryland tips into West Virginia. It's the source of the North Branch of the Potomac. He was surveying the western, one of the western ends of the Fairfax Grant. It's called the Fairfax Stone. Nobody visits it. It's very not a popular tourist site. Jefferson's father went farther west than Jefferson ever did. He very seldom in his life went west of the Blue Ridge, which you can see in Charlottesville.
And it's remarkable when you step in, just brief interjection, when you step into to Monticello, not only are you met with a lot of artwork and artifacts, but they're almost all from the American West. I mean, it's a profound part of Jefferson's life.
Yeah, he commissions other people to do this. He collects the maps. He collects the artifacts. So Monticello today, the way they've got it set up, you've got the artifacts that he was given by Lewis and Clark when they returned on their expedition, from their expedition that he sent them out on in 1804, out through the Louisiana Territory and out to the West. One of the things that surprised me about Jefferson, I read through his Notes on Virginia, a book that I had looked at before, but had never read systematically. And it's an interesting sort of compendium book. It starts off very dryly, but gets very interesting. And he has an adapted version of his father's map, the Jefferson Fry map, in the front, and which includes not only what is now Virginia, West Virginia, and Kentucky, which were part of Virginia then, but also much of Pennsylvania and everything. It doesn't really have much on the Atlantic coast. It doesn't include New York or West New England at all. It's looking west, and in the Notes of Virginia, he goes beyond the Mississippi River. He's writing in the 1780s when the Mississippi River has been accepted as the western boundary in the Treaty of Paris. He talks about, there's this Missouri River that goes out there, and he starts describing what a big river the Missouri is. And then he tells his reader how many miles it is to go from Santa Fe to Mexico City. He gets it close to right. At least on the roads as they exist, according to my Google Maps today. It's about 1,500 miles, something like that. He's looking out towards the west. That's his orientation is always to the west. So I mentioned earlier that he created that township plan, and we're going to have each township will be 6 square miles by 6 square miles. One of them will be devoted to paying for schools, for public education, and this is followed in so much of the westward movement of in the Northwest Territory and otherwise going west. He gets to the Louisiana Purchase, but he sends Lewis and Clark all the way to the Pacific, which is not included in the Louisiana Purchase. He's always interested in the West. He's not interested in the seaboard at all. That's not his turf. He foresees a republic of yeoman farmers who are, I think, he expects to be deferential to the local big landlord like himself. He expected deference from other people, and he got it. It's a contrast there that's very interesting. Alexander Hamilton, great antagonists in Washington's cabinet, and the founders, roughly, of what were functional equivalent political parties, which they said they hated. Hamilton has another phrase. Hamilton, at one point in his writing, says, if you look at the United States, he says, on your left side is British Canada and New England with the shipyards and so forth. On your right-hand side is Spanish Florida and the plantation colonies of the Carolinas and Georgia. Well, what are you looking at when New England is on your left and the Carolinas are on your right? You're looking out over the Atlantic Ocean. You're looking out at the invisible sea lanes that tied together the trading cities of the world, the cities of New York and London, Bristol, Glasgow, the British Isles, with the West Indies, where Hamilton came from. And of course, when you see him as a young man living in the horrible circumstances that he did, abandoned by the father, the mother dies, the guardian commits suicide. This is, I mean, talk about a dysfunctional youth. He's a clerk in an office for a couple New York merchants. They go away for medical care. He takes over at age 17. He orders ship captains to change their route. He collects debts that these guys had never been able to collect. He does transactions in multiple currencies and figures out how to arbitrage. And you know,
he's brilliant.
Yeah, I compared him at one point with the almost precise contemporary, born about the same time, died young, Wolfgang Amadeus Mozart.
It's a good comparison.
They just could do things that you can't imagine a human being doing. And but Hamilton sees, he mentions in his writing, Hamburg, the Hanseatic cities, Amsterdam, London, the merchant cities in Florence. He sees the United States, which builds up a commercial and in time an industrial economy. And remember, the 18th century was a time when, you know, when you look at those long-term economic growth things, there wasn't such a thing as economic growth. The idea, people's ideas was economies were kind of stagnant. Sometimes you got good years and then too many people were born and they didn't have enough to eat and you had bad years. Thomas Malthus is writing about that circa 1802, just when economic growth in the English-speaking world and parts of Western Europe is suddenly accelerating. Hamilton sees that acceleration. He lived by it. He vibrates to it. He wants the United States to participate in it. And so that gives him a whole different perspective from Jefferson. And they see it kind of, they're of course political opponents. And you can see why Hamilton backs the National Bank, why Hamilton backs the national debt, the consolidation of the state debts, and favors the report on manufacturers and so forth. While Jefferson is against all these things, Jefferson wants to encourage the land in the West. Jefferson proposes a Northwest Territory without slavery, by the way, which ultimately was passed by other people, but in 1787. But they're different things. But you know, of course, what happens is we get a country that has both things.
Imagine that.
It's not quite what they wanted in either case. We're not quite as commercial and loving of banks as Alexander Hamilton would like us to be. The yeoman farmers of the West and the Southwest are not as deferential to their nominal local superiors as Thomas Jefferson expected them to be. It doesn't turn out, but it turns out that we do develop in both ways. That George Washington was wise to a point. You know, people don't think of George Washington as a hugely intelligent man, as a genius. You read about him, it becomes obvious he was a pretty smart guy. But he also, he appoints Jefferson and Hamilton, who in many ways are his intellectual superior. Hamilton has this enormous knowledge. Jefferson, who dabbles in a lot of things, is a writer of transcendent genius. Is the all men are created equal, all that stuff. Boy,
it shows
it's beautifully done. And Washington is capable of hiring people that are that good.
Exactly. That's just what I was about to say, which shows his gift and his confidence as a leader. So is America better off by having 200 years later those two strains of thought in our politics?
Well, yes. I mean, you don't get to be a continental-sized nation with 5% of the population, 25% of the economy, 50+% of military capacity just by doing one thing. But beyond that, I think one of the things that I got out of work on this book, and I tried to, and I put some of it, these thoughts into it. We were the happy result of a lot of contingencies that easily could not have happened. There are a lot of counterfactuals where things could have gone wrong. And the other thing is diversity. You know, we hear it talked about today. Oh, we're suddenly a diverse nation. We didn't used to be a diverse nation before. We were all just one kind of people. And I don't know. The founders occasionally talk that way. But in fact, they knew we were dealing with a diverse nation. I mean, the collection of colonies, one of the things that Benjamin Franklin contributed that I think was not sufficiently appreciated by a lot of people today, maybe in history, he's one of the first ones that has an idea of the colonies having a unity. The being a unit, his Albany Plan of Union in 1754, which was advanced to oppose the French conquering the Ohio Valley. He created a business that transcended colonial lines. Poor Richard's Almanac, he was a printer in Philadelphia. His Poor Richard's Almanac was sold up and down the Atlantic seacoast and in the Sugar Islands of the Caribbean. He franchised his printing operations and got a share of the profits in other colonies. But he also he sponsored the evangelist George Whitefield to have these monster rallies in the first the Enlightenment of the first Enlightenment of the 1740s. Became a friend of Whitefield's, even though he wasn't particularly religious conventionally himself. But Franklin has this idea that we're going to be one unit. But they also know New England was founded by Calvinists. Didn't welcome anybody else aside from Calvinists living there. And they'd expel some of them. They went to, that's how you got Rhode Island and New Haven as separate colonies. They were expelled from Massachusetts. You had Virginia, South the Carolinas created by Anglicans. Pennsylvania by Quakers. Maryland by Catholic, the Calvert family, Catholic proprietors. New York, unruly New York, created by the Dutch Reform people, conquered by King James II as Duke of York, after whom it's named. It was a diverse country. They did not have to read David Hackett Fisher's Albion Seed, which it was published in 1989, a wonderful book that describes how different British folkways of all kinds of things were brought from different parts of the British Isles.
Tremendous book.
Different parts of North America. But they knew Albion Seed root and branch. They were very much aware of this. And so the whole project of creating a constitution, James Madison has this insight that Montesquieu had taught that large republics didn't work. You just had city states. Republics only worked for city states, maybe for the Dutch and Little Holland, Little Swiss. There wasn't really a Swiss confederation then, and so forth. And Madison says, no, a large republic, a geographically large republic. And remember, the land they get out of the Treaty of Paris, about the size of Western Europe. A large republic can have, if it has a government that is limited in its powers, so there's room for local variation, and which has checks and balances so that you can't get temporary majorities just overwhelming everybody else and getting rid of their rights and trampling on them, that this can be a workable formula. And the Constitution that he more than anybody else does to set that up is important in that way.
It's genius. That's a perfect lead-in to one last question. This has been a wonderful conversation. And it's a last question, Michael, about the modern day. And that is, what needs to change about our politics, our society, heck, our understanding of the founding, in order for more Americans tomorrow to wake up hopeful about the American dream and the American future?
I think one thing is to have, for us to have a better developed sense of tragedy and of contingency. Think about, I've spent some time in Europe in the last few years, and one of the things that that you do when you spend time in Europe is you think about what was happening there. Not so long ago, within the edge of my lifetime, the lifetime of some people still living who are older than I am, and how many people were destroyed in what were very advanced civilizations, the elements of tragedy, the elements of contingency. I think if I could convince Americans of one thing, I would say to you, you ought to have a sense of nationalism and national pride, not because you're wonderful, but because you are the lucky inheritors of a series of happy contingencies, a series of great leadership and great creativity on the part of a lot of people, including people outside of government and politics, people that none of us have ever heard of. Or ever will hear of, that we have a great responsibility, in my view. I think, really, to the whole world. I know some people, especially some conservatives today, will say, no, be that. But that we are lucky inheritors. And when we say we have national pride, it's not pride in our own achievement as individuals or as members of the baby boom or whatever generation you may claim to be a member of or something. Not maybe pride in what we've done lately. We see some mistakes. We we argue about what our government, what we should be doing in our private life, our private institutions. But we should have pride in it. We should have a sense of how lucky we are. And that luck confers responsibility, doesn't it? It means that we have a responsibility to carry on the good parts, the strengths of our heritage, and of the things that we have been the lucky beneficiaries of. We should appreciate that more. We stand at a place in history hugely privileged. It doesn't make us oppressors, by the way, but hugely privileged. But privilege means responsibility. Privilege means not just, the enjoyment of pleasure, but the performance of duty. And I think we have duties that are conferred upon us by the great deeds of our American past.
Michael Barone. It was a real pleasure and honor to sit here with you. The book was fantastic. We look forward to having you back.
Well, thank you very much. My gosh.
I told you would enjoy the conversation. I promise you will enjoy the book, Mental Maps of the Founders. And obviously, in Michael Barone's last comment, we do have a duty as Americans, not just to keep smiling, but really to lean into institutions, into the responsibilities we have, the duties we have that, of course, are wedded to the freedoms we enjoy. We are going to restore this great country. Keep your chin up. Take care.
The Kevin Roberts Show is brought to you by more than 500,000 members of the Heritage Foundation. The executive producer is Crystal Kate Bonham. Sound design by Lauren Evans, Mark Guiney, and Tim Kennedy. For more information and to subscribe, please visit heritage.org.